The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Office bound, Taoiseach says we could be returning to workplaces by August. Outdoor summer, should we have designated drinking areas in our cities? Just transition, opposition say climate bill will let down the most vulnerable, and fears that Limerick COVID spike will impact leaving certs. All that and more on tonight's Late Debate, but first the news with Shane McGann. Thanks, Shane. Good evening and welcome to Tuesday's Late Debate. Joining us tonight, we have Jennifer Carl-McNeill, Fine Gael TD for Dún-Laoghaire and party spokesperson on equality. Pather Tobin, TD for Meath West and leader of Aonthu. Labour Party Senator Annie Hoey and Senate spokesperson on education, research, innovation and science. And Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent with Independent Newspapers. We want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate_RTE. Now, as you heard there in the bulletin, the Taoiseach has said that government may signal at the end of this month that some workers can return to their offices by the end of August. Micheál Martin said a lot more people will be vaccinated by August and this allows for a vaccine dividend. Just 5 weeks ago, the Taoiseach was warning that a phased return to the office for people working from home was not likely to commence until September. So, Jennifer Carl-McNeill, what changed?
The success of the vaccination programme, the COVID and the response to COVID has always been an iterative process, depending on where we are, both in terms of opening up and closing down. This is a pretty, we're at 55% of people have had a first vaccination, 26% are fully vaccinated. Things are going well, she says cautiously, always cautiously. But, you know, it is time to have that conversation about the right time to get back to work. There are lots of different types of workplaces, lots of different types of employers who will have different needs, different types of buildings with different ventilation systems. This is exactly the time to be working out how and when we go back to work safely and in what way. But what we really want is to encourage as much flexible and remote working as possible, from a lifestyle perspective, from a climate perspective. And these are the sorts of things that organisations hope, you know, should be thinking about. In Dún-Laoghaire, in my own area, we're trying to provide new options for remote hubs so that people can get 10 minutes to an office in Dún-Laoghaire instead of being 50 or 60 minutes into an office in the city centre. So I think we're going to see, I hope, a lot more flexibility for businesses and employers. And, you know, now is the time to be having the conversation about the best way to get back for people.
Are you concerned at this, Pather?
I think the context of this is that we are at very low numbers with regards to the amount of people with COVID in hospital. So 77 people today, which is great news, have COVID in hospital. It's not great news for them, but it's great news that the figure is low. And, you know, just to put that into context, all of those people would fit into one double-decker bus. It's a low number throughout the whole country at the moment. And we do need to get back to work. We do need to get parts of the country alive again. One of the worries I would have, though, is when this crisis hit, we were told this is going to change the way we work as a country in future, and that there was going to be a dividend, especially for regional and rural Ireland, that many people would be able to, you know, work in Donegal or Kerry or Meath and tip into the office once a week, etc. My instinct is that that's not going to happen because, you know, first of all, I have asked the government how many remote working hubs are in the state. The government told me they don't have a data set with regards to the number of remote working hubs. They've spent 50 million years, or 50 million
Might
euros.
Might be a slight exaggeration.
50 million euros over the last 10 years on remote working hubs. So there's very little investment going in. And many people in the countryside still have problems with broadband. And we see just very recently that the promises of development in broadband haven't happened this year, and rollout is extremely slow. So that ability for people and rural Ireland to benefit from a change in the working structure is still not there.
Yeah, and there must be, in particular in your constituency, people who would have commuted daily in the past who have really appreciated not having to do that now. Yeah. And will they now feel under serious pressure now that the statement has been made from on high that we want to see people, getting back into their workplaces from August?
I can't exaggerate how difficult this is for people. More people leave Meath to work than actually work in the county. So the majority of workers leave the county to commute, which is an incredible thing. And typically, commute times are 2 hours and maybe 3 hours for people in my community. In you know, in smaller villages and towns like Clonmelon, for example, you could play hurling on the main street of the town on a Friday because everybody is in Dublin. And there's a real problem with the spatial development of this country. And unless there is a sea change, we're developing into a city state where we have an overheating capital. And we have, you know, a sprawling commuter belt where people are living in real difficulty, spending hours trying to get to work every day. And the remote working environment is a chance to break that. I do believe that the government should be pushing that hard into the future.
Okay. I'll let you in a second. I just don't want to let Annie in first.
Yeah, I suppose when we're talking about people going back to work, we're kind of ignoring the fact that actually a huge amount of people have been working throughout all of this. And that the narrative of going back to work, certainly when I'm thinking of some of my friends, young people who have been going in and out for the last while, but also when we're talking about who's going back to work, there are a number of people who aren't going to be going back to work. We've got 53% unemployment rate of young people, and there's a lot of sectors that are really going to struggle, I think, over the next while. So while it feels like perhaps maybe it's maybe being sold somewhat as a good news story, like things are getting better, things are getting back to normal, there's a whole underlay, I think, in this that we're not talking about. And what are we going to do about young people? Like 53% unemployment is bonkers. Like that's incredibly dangerous. That's incredibly worrying. As I said, there's a lot of people who would have lost their jobs over the past year who need to upskill, they need to retrain. So it's not just a conversation about who's going back into work. We also need to have a conversation about what are we going to do about all the people who aren't going back into work. And there isn't a good news story for them come August.
Okay, but let's stick with the people who are going to be going back to work just in relation to this. It's been referred to, and the Taoiseach referred to today, that this is allowed for because we have a vaccine, Devidin. You mentioned it yourself, Jennifer. But I was just before we came down, I saw on primetime Mark Coughlan running through some of the statistics in relation to vaccination and herd immunity and where we will be and where we need to be. And so there's obviously lots of figures floated around. We're not clear depending on what variants are in the community and all of that. But if you take 85% vaccination rate is what is considered to be, you know, a reasonable assumption in terms of what we would need for herd immunity. And he's saying that assuming a very high uptake, like 90% of people take it up, by September, we will have 65% of population immunity. And to get anywhere near to get up to the figure, the magic figure of 85%, you need everybody over the age of 10 vaccinated. And of course, that's not even on our agenda yet in terms of people under the age of 16.
Okay, well, I go with the facts coming from Neffet and NIAC, and I respect all of the analysis that's going on. You did hear me exercise a note of caution in everything that I said. But what we have is a vaccination programme that is going well and that is having effect. The vaccines are efficacious. It's important that, you know, that we recognise that. Annie is right to reflect the scale of youth unemployment, and it's a really important challenge for the country. We know that we're expecting 80,000 people to be back at work, you know, from the quarter four to the end of the year, that will recover 220,000 the following year. That is actually what the biggest challenge in many ways that the state faces, is regaining full employment as quickly as we can. But I just want to go back to something that Padraig said about the number of hubs. You know, they suggested that the government had no data whatsoever, but you know, the minister updated the Dáil on the 27th of May. She said we've mapped out 326 hubs, another 43 are being scoped out, so we'll soon have close to 400 hubs mapped out and 100 delivered by the end of this year. So that's from 27th of May. You may have something.
It's
more
a parliamentary question
that
from May as well, to be honest, from the minister.
Yes, exactly. So that's exactly.
No, but my figure, the response by the minister is in May of this month, which basically said that they didn't have a data set with regards to the amount of remote working hubs throughout the country.
Literally 27th of May, we've mapped out 326 hubs, another 43 are in progress, so we'll soon have close to 400 hubs mapped out. But what, you know what I mean, it's there on the Dáil record, it's there, the work is being done. But what we need to see as well is a whole range of other options as well. So for example, in Dunleary, one of the things that we're trying to do is repurpose small areas of commercial space. Digital Dunleary is leading this to try and make sure that we have centres of innovation, centres of places where you can have outposts from city centre or like Sandyford type businesses, so that you can walk or cycle to those businesses just as easily as you know, trying to travel into town, which is
okay.
A huge climate.
Let me bring Hugh O'Connell in. Hugh, I'm just listening to Jennifer there and indeed Pather, and talking about, you know, how we need to
have hubs in operation and not have everything, you know, focused on the city centre. But I imagine, and I know because the Thornish referred to this some months ago, that some of this business of getting people back into offices, because there's a whole economy around the city that depends on people being in the city centre and buying coffees and buying salads and wraps, and that economy, and that has been built up around that office population.
Yeah, buying newspapers as well, Katie. I mean, that's a market that, I mean, particularly the weekday sales of newspapers, I think, have fallen across the board because people aren't coming into town. They're not getting a paper before they get on the dart. And you're right. There's a whole ecosystem of companies and businesses that rely on people commuting, I guess. And if that's not happening, you know, you look at something like CIE, for example, and the issue, you know, financial issues they've had there, and the huge state interventions that have been required there over the last nearly 2 years now, because of the pandemic and the reduced capacity. There's no guarantee that when you know, the 50% capacity limit on public transport is eased, that people will come flooding back to public transport infrastructure. I mean, I was saying to one of your researchers before I came on the programme, you know, I think there'll be a lot of hesitancy about kind of people packing into a Lewis or into a Dart in the manner in which they did pre-pandemic, almost like sardines at rush hour. So, but yeah, I mean, look, the government is conscious of, and I know that the Finance Minister, Pascal Dunne, in particular, is very concerned about the fact that the offices have been pretty much empty for the last year and a half, and it's something that they're very keen that as soon as the public health conditions allow it, that people would slowly migrate back to the offices. But I mean, I think fundamentally the pandemic has changed a lot of people's views about going into the office every day. So I think you're probably going to end up in a lot of companies with this sort of hybrid model of people working maybe 3 or 4 days a week in the office and the other 1 or 2 days at home. I think that's probably the future for an awful lot of workers. And I think as well, you know, as your discussion before referenced, there will be this idea of regional hubs where, you know, Liv Radker has spoken about this idea of using some of the old bank buildings that will no longer be occupied by banks because banks seem to be shutting down branches nowadays, that they would be converted into these kind of remote community hubs and remote working spaces for people so that they wouldn't necessarily have to commute and they could stay within their community. And that could contribute to the vibrancy of towns and villages up and down the country.
Indeed. The other issue, of course, is, and you touched on it as well there, Jennifer, is like, are we prepared? Are we taking the right steps in terms of preparing buildings for people to come back in big numbers? I just want to have a listen now to the Assistant Professor of the School of Architecture, Planning and Environmental Policy in UCD, Orla Hegarty, who is of course also a member of the expert group on the role of ventilation in reducing transmission of COVID-19.
I think the core of the recommendations is that we have a really good understanding now of how the virus is transmitted, and that is another really strong tool in the toolbox. Vaccines are not the only tool. Once we understand, and people do with an outdoor summer, that the risk is low in clean air, we need to start then adopting clean air policies for buildings. And the core recommendation there is that if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. So we need to start looking closely at, rather than sectoral rules, looking specifically at individual buildings so that the ones that are high risk can be addressed.
Yeah, are we actually putting in place the infrastructure to do this? Because that's a huge job, surely, checking buildings individually to see if they have the ventilation and the setup.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's exactly why I said,
I know you're talking about it, but I'm saying I don't see hordes of people out there at, you know, in and out of buildings looking at their ventilation systems.
Each building is going to be different. Each employer is going to have to look at that. The government will discuss, you know,
who's making them do that?
Well, this is exactly the process that we're beginning with NEFID, to get the guidelines, to get to see exactly what buildings need what. I mean, we know, for example, that there are different building regulations. You can tell from the building regulations whether you're an old building. We know we have so much data and technology about the buildings that we have, depending on when they've been built.
But are we not opening up loads of restaurants in 4 weeks' time? Who has been going around checking those restaurants to see if they have adequate ventilation to provide for the number of people they're going to be serving food to? Because that is, as Orla Hegarty has said today very clearly, that is one of the real high-risk indoor hospitality, where people are talking and laughing and eating at close quarters with no masks on, is a high-risk environment. I haven't heard of anybody going to any restaurant and establishing whether they have proper ventilation in place for this.
Yeah, and I think where we've been looking at that is the distance between tables, the duration of all that. And it is difficult. But when you're looking at employers coming in, people spending all day long there, it's even more important. It's even more difficult because if you're potentially spending 8 hours, it's a very different thing to spending 2 hours or 2.5 hours going in and out of a restaurant.
But the employees are in that building for 8 hours and longer, often hospitality hours being very long. I'm a little.
But isn't that exactly why this conversation needs to happen? This is exactly why the Orla is raising
those points. But we're opening in 4 weeks. They haven't done it.
In relation to, there's a big difference between spending a day in work in an office for 8 hours and 2.5 hours. I'm not discounting the risk.
I'm talking about the employees in those hospitality. They spend that month. That is their workplace. Mm. We are putting them back into those workplaces. In many cases, young people who have not been vaccinated. And I'm saying
the same issue has been there with schools and the same issue has been there with creches. And we've had to adapt to each one of those. We were listening to the creche owners, for example, today talking about how they've had to been working in pods, how they've had to change things considerably. It is difficult for every single sector.
But you're saying we must do it, but we haven't done it, is what I'm saying. And I don't see any indication it's going to be done between now and when we open for indoor dining. Can you tell me that there's anything being put in place that people will go, that there will be... people with this expertise will be sent into restaurants around the country to establish whether or not they have proper ventilation?
No, I can't answer that tonight.
Annie?
Like that, and I think you hit the nail on the head, actually, that the people who are working there, that is their workplace. These are people, by the way, who have been castigated very often because of their age group over the past couple of months and being linked to all sorts of things. And I think it's very... This isn't a new pandemic, even though it's theory new. You know, we've had this for a while, and that there isn't a body in charge of the health and safety of businesses, or either public businesses such as restaurants and stuff like that, or businesses, offices that we're talking about people going back to in August. That's very worrying, both for, I think, an employer or employees being like, I'm going to be brought back in. I might not have my vaccine yet. I might have to come back in. And if the place I'm working isn't sticking to regulations, who do I go to? Where do I go to? How do I know? There's an awful lot of goodwill riding and a lot of this, and a lot of people have to trust that their employers are looking after them. And I think the vast majority of them are doing their absolute level best to get things back in order. But I think it is, you're absolutely right, Katie, it's very worrying that there's no body or no person or no group.
First of all, the scale of government activity is incredible. If you look at Pfizer and how it adapted to the pandemic, it upscaled radically the level of production that it was carrying out. But if you look at the state here, the state hasn't actually changed that much in terms of capacity within hospitals. You're talking about going back to work. This is not the first time we're going back to work. This is about the third time that we're going back to work as a people. And we're still talking about these issues in the future, that if you take away the future tense to a certain extent, the government have very little to say. And in the same with what happened on the streets of Dublin, for example, over the last weekend, it wasn't the first time that we saw massive crowds congregating. Even in February and March, there were a couple of days of sunshine where we saw parks and everybody fretted afterwards about how terrible it was, but yet nothing was put in place when it happened again.
Okay, just a question in here or on Twitter. The big question is, when will politicians get back to their workplace at all, rather than being in a position of privilege and renting out the convention centre at a cost to every citizen?
Go back tomorrow, if they would let us. Go back tomorrow. It has a huge impact on productivity and being able to get things done as soon as possible. And the politicians have been agitating for that for some time.
But Ciarán Cóirla is very reluctant and cites public health advice every time. And
the business committee makes this decision. The government have a majority in the Business Commission. The Business Commission in Dáil can make that decision.
Hugh is going to clarify whatever. I hear a tone there.
Well, yeah, I mean, like there is as you've heard from Pater and Jennifer there, there's a strong desire to get back to Leinster House. The problem is that the Ciarán Cóirla and the Houses of the Oireachtas Commission, the senior officials within the Houses of the Oireachtas are very clear that the health and safety advice is that it would be too dangerous, effectively, to have more than 350 people coming into Leinster House every day, as would be the case if TDs and senators were to return to Leinster House, and then all the ancillary staff as well. So, and journalists. Which is very important, of course. So I think that because of that, the feeling now is that it won't be until September. But you're right, Pater, that the government does have a majority on the business committee, and the business committee makes these decisions. And my understanding of it is that when it's come down to the business committee and everyone's agitating to go back, in the end, the government representatives on that committee don't want to annoy the Ceann Comhairle and the officials within the Oireachtas to such an extent as to basically override the very clear health and safety advice. And also, there's obviously the public perception might change if it's found that these politicians have overridden the public health advice not to return to Leinster House. At the moment, it's looking like September, and that means that every day the Oireachtas is sitting down in the convention centre. It's costing in and around 20,000 euros a day. That is an enormous cost to the state. I haven't met a politician who likes the convention centre.
Is there one other parliament in Europe at the moment that is decamped into another location? In all the other parliaments that I've looked at, and I have looked at this, they have managed to work out some hybrid system of resolving this. Now, we're told by the government that there's a constitutional problem with regards to the Dáil not sitting in just one location.
That's actually the Oireachtas position, Pater. That's the legal advice. That's the legal advice to the Oireachtas is that constitutionally it's not possible.
We have a bill ourselves. I published it last August. Will you vote for it?
I'll happily vote for it. Because the idea that we're still talking about this again 15 months in is absolutely incredible. 25 grand a day is costing. There's a special school in my own constituency that has had to stop hot meals for their children because they don't have the funding, and we have the largesse of the political establishment spending 25 grand a day on a 2,000 seater building when half the time there's only a dozen people in it.
And the other thing is, we could easily be in the Dáil on Tuesdays and Thursdays if there has to be a requirement for the vote. That's Wednesday. We've been doing that on Wednesday night. We could do that Wednesday night. We could be in the Dáil Tuesdays and Thursdays and manage our attendance as we did at the beginning, as we did in the COVID committee. And you know, the sooner we get back there, as far as I'm concerned,
the better. That underlines the silliness of it all is the fact that during the first wave, the Dáil was regularly sitting in Leinster House, and no one really batted an eyelid about that, and it was done with COVID protocols in place and social distancing and limits on the number of TDs that could be in the chamber at any one time. But now you have the Shannon sits in the Dáil, and the Dáil sits in the convention centre, and it's just it's all very bizarre, really.
Okay, let's move on, because you touched on it there, Pather, and we do want to talk about what happened last weekend. The question was raised today: should we have designated areas for public drinking in our cities? This is following, as you say, what happened in Dublin City Centre last weekend. This is a proposal put forward by the Fianna Fáil councillor Alan Cheevers today. 3 Gardaí were injured and 55 people were arrested in incidents in Dublin over the City Centre weekend. Are we going to go to... Yes, I think we can go to Executive Director of the Irish Council of Civil Liberties, Liam Herrick, because the ICCL has called for a full review of what happened in relation to that Garda operation over the weekend. Good night. Good evening, Liam.
Good evening, Katie.
Liam, why do we need a full review?
Well, I think as you've just laid out there, Katie, it was a very serious set of events. We've had guards injured, we've had a significant number of people arrested, and we've also had a significant use of force and the public order unit on the streets of the capital. I think we don't know the full facts about what happened yet, but certainly there's been video footage and eyewitness statements about baton charges on the South William Street area on Friday night. We had sections of the city closed off. Ordinary people going about their business weren't able to cross the city centre. Periods on Saturday night. There's reports of the use of batons on members of the public, and people saw significant number of guards and shields in the city centre. And any time that things get to that point, it's a significant incident that needs a report. And this is a question about accountability, and it's a question of public trust in policing. And in fact, one of the positive outcomes of COVID over the last year has been an increase in transparency about the use of force by the guards, but because of the sensitivity around COVID and the extraordinary powers the guards have had, both the Garda and the policing authority have in fact published far more data about the use of force than we'd usually get. So we wrote to the Assistant Commissioner responsible for Dublin today and the policing authority and the Department of Justice, calling for a full report, and we don't want to prejudge what's going to come out of that, not just into the operations Friday, Saturday and Sunday night and what happened, but also the planning and the coordination with the local authority and businesses, and indeed what questions about government policy and confused messages do we need to examine to understand what happened and to make sure we can prevent it happening in future.
Talk to me about that last element that you refer to there, confused messages and government messaging?
Well, I think, you know, this is something that Dublin City Council have identified. Some Garda spokespersons have also identified that what outdoor socialising meant has caused some degree of confusion. And when the government announced the policy encouraging people to socialise outdoors, it would seem that their focus was very much on what happened yesterday, where we had outdoor dining and outdoor drinking in bars and restaurants. But there was an interim period where people were, by the Taoiseach and by members of the government, encouraged to socialise outdoors. And yet there was no obvious structured way for them to do that. At the same time, there have been pubs and licensed premises selling takeaway drink. And certainly in Dublin city centre, many of these pubs were selling takeaway drink, and the drink was being consumed in the city centre and proximate to that as well. Now, whether that was right or wrong, I think there's certainly a set of mixed messages. The law was being applied unevenly in different places. There was confusion, I think, in some parts of the public as to what was legal and what was not legal.
Yeah, can I just ask you...
It's a separate question.
Can I just ask you in relation... Sorry to cut across you, Liam, but just exactly that point. Because this idea is, and if you look on social media, there is a very strong sense now that it's a fundamental human right to be allowed to drink alcohol in the public place of your choosing. Whereas up until very recently, it was, I think, generally assumed that that wasn't the case, that there were, you know, laws and regulations around drinking alcohol in public.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of confusion now. I mean, it's not a fundamental human right, but it is a major factor in trying to manage public order in an urban area. And the balance of public order policing that we've had in Dublin and elsewhere for decades is that how licensed premises operate, how the sale of alcohol operates, is a critical factor in allowing the guards to plan how they're going to manage public order. And we've had a very unclear situation for the last couple of weeks. Now, in most parts of Dublin and around the country, it hasn't been particularly problematic. There's been issues about litter. There's been some public order issues that have been dealt with in a proportionate way. But I think what's happened in Dublin over the last couple of weekends is a concentration of a very large number of people in a small area, not in controlled environments of pubs, but drinking on the street. And it has produced significant problems. And I think we do need to understand why that happened, and we need to make sure it doesn't happen again in the future.
What do you think of that proposal for designated outdoor drinking areas in cities?
Well, I think, you know, we need to, of course, be careful about large crowds at the moment for public health reasons. But Dublin City Council and the guards have shown over the last 10 years in particular an incredible capacity to manage outdoor eating and drinking in parks like Merrion Square, the Ivy Gardens and other parts of the city at festivals, very often free festivals during the summer. So they clearly can manage that. And we made the point last week that, in fact, next week, Dublin was meant to be hosting the European Football Championships with designated eating and drinking areas of up to 10,000 people. Now, that's not appropriate at the moment, but certainly it should be possible to manage some crowds. And as with everything to do with COVID, the rules affect different sections of the population disproportionately. There's a lot of people in Dublin living in apartments that don't have access to gardens. They're living in shared accommodation. And it is not unreasonable that the city wouldn't try to facilitate them socialising outdoors in a safe way. Now, that doesn't mean that people can drink as much as they want in an uncontrolled manner, but it does mean that the city council could go some way towards facilitating it. And if you look at what's happening in Cork, where the city council has invested a lot in trying to facilitate outdoor socialising, eating and drinking, they seem to be coming up with better outcomes.
Yeah. Can you stay with us, Liam, for a moment? And I just want to put that to our panel. Annie, you have worked in event management.
Yeah. I used to work at festivals. So I know that there are hundreds of people in the event sector who are literally crying out for work at the moment. They have the skill set. I mean, not all festivals are, you know, absolutely outrageous, off the walls thing. They're crowd management. They're managing people being in very safe spaces, consuming alcohol. You know, there's lots of things that happen. And I think that we need proper public order planning or public realm planning. And I think there's currently a deficit in our cities in that with regards to managing outdoor drinking and socialising. I think Lee made a really good point. We have an awful lot of people who don't have gardens or spaces to socialise, and we have co-living and we have student accommodation and overcrowded accommodation and people who are working in the front line and have been working throughout this entire pandemic, and they have nowhere to go. And it is not reasonable to say the only people who can socialise are those who A, have their own garden, or B, can afford to go to pay money to sit in the outdoor area of a patio or a restaurant or anything like that. Like, we have public spaces, we have public realm, and people should be able to use those.
Yeah. Yeah, Jennifer, you're nodding along to that.
I am, really, because I mean, it was about maximising the public realm and preparing it for people to be outside. I mean, Fine Gael councillors and Dublin City Council called for this months ago for a city centre recovery plan to do precisely this. We've done that partially in Dunleary, though I recognise there's more space there than there is necessarily in Dublin City Centre where there's a higher population. But we went about repurposing the public realm to make it comfortable, to facilitate that. Now, you know, then you do see initiatives like in Merrion Square that the week before last, they were putting down, you know, the nice circles to make it clear, the different pods, and to try and, you know, that's a sort of an encouraging behaviour to try and, you know, please sit here, please sit there, you know. But it was about trying to do that everywhere and trying to make as much space as possible. At the same time, some of the behaviour that we saw really wasn't, really went way too far. It wasn't sort of public, normal
scenes,
public order behaviour.
Those scenes,
it's a different category. We have to recognise that, you know.
But those scenes of, in particular, the I think the one that grabbed everyone was the Garda, kind of with their batons drawn, kind of pushing back against a crowd in South William Street on Saturday night or on Friday night. Were you concerned when you saw those pictures in terms of how, you know, policing by consent and how Gardaí would...
Absolutely, always about that, because we do have policing by consent. But I'm also recognising, Liam said the same thing, you know, that there needs to be a full report into that. Neither I nor you saw everything that happened there. And it does concern me. But I'm well aware that I didn't see the whole thing, and I'd like somebody who is able to gather all of that evidence and see it from all the different angles to be able to do that. It's not for me to judge that.
And so you would go along with the call for a full report review of what occurred?
I think that's a reasonable thing to do when there were such serious incidents and when you've Gardaí hurt and you've people you know impacted in that way. I think that's a reasonable thing.
Okay.
I just think that last weekend was one of the most mind-bending experiences I've seen since I've become an elected representative. It was just really hard to understand that the government, first of all, invited people out and to socialise outside, spent money on billboards telling people to come out and socialise outside, and then allowed pubs to serve pints to people only when they were mobile and gathered in big groups, not when they were seated in pods, properly distanced from each other. And then to do it in streets where it was actually illegal, I understand, to actually drink in public anyways. It was like, you know, 4 or 5 opposite policies operating against each other at the same time. It was a recipe for disaster. And the fact that it happened after the previous week, where we were all discussing exactly the same thing. I've listened to so many debates about this, where everybody's talking about what should happen, and nobody's actually putting into place what we need to put into place now to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And I listened to that Fianna Fáil councillor talk about designated drinking spaces. We have designated drinking spaces. They're called pubs. And right now, in most European countries, they're open safely. We're allowing people to drink in hotels and eat in hotels. Leo said last week on Morning Ireland, there's no science behind the decision to allow for drinking and eating in hotels and to stop it from happening in pubs and restaurants. It should be open in all hospitality under the same science and under the same regulation.
Okay, Hugh.
Sorry, none of that, you know, legitimises anybody throwing a glass bottle at Ungard Street Corner or anything.
No, absolutely,
you know,
not. But the government was responsible for what happened through
the
legislation that it brought
in. The reopening is staged for a reason, to try and bring things out, you know, in a paced way. And that's the way that it's been done. And it has been reasonably successful so far. But none of that means that it's okay to suddenly become a thug and throw glass bottles.
Nobody's saying that. That's absolutely wrong. But last week was a confluence of incompetence by the government. All of those situations coming together led to that.
You just said the government was responsible for that sort of behaviour.
No, I'm saying the government was responsible for bringing people onto the streets, telling people that they couldn't sit to have their drinks in a measured, distant, safe manner.
But
only
lots of people did.
But no, the pubs were told that they couldn't actually have people at tables outside.
Most people did sit in separate ways. Most people didn't engage in that sort of behaviour. Most people tried to behave reasonably.
Jennifer, you're conflating two different issues. I am not in any way saying it was right for those thugs to attack the Gardaí. It was absolutely wrong. But the governments were created the recipe for that event.
Hugh, I want to bring you in and put you some figures that Paul Murphy obtained last week in relation to how the COVID regulations are being enforced. And really some quite startling figures that half of all COVID fines that were given out in Dublin were given in just two districts, in Ballymun and in Blanchardstown. That's almost 3,000 in all. And there was just, that compares to 75 in Dunleary and 88 in Terenure. And the other figure that was really startling from those stats was 77% of all COVID fines were to people under the age of 35.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I don't know enough about that, the reason behind that, but I would suspect that just perhaps in those areas where the fines, where the been the highest number of fines, is perhaps a greater Garda presence, so they're more, I suppose, vigilant and on the lookout for this kind of stuff, and they catch more of it perhaps, whereas there would be less of a Garda presence perhaps in places like Dunleary, and in terms of the under 35s, I mean, yeah, that stands to reason in the sense that a lot of under 35s have been out and about trying to socialise and have some degree of normality in their lives after a very or over the course of the last, you know, 6, 7, 8 months since these fines were introduced, and you know, whereas older people have been generally kind of shielding indoors or whatever, you know, certainly not getting out as much as younger people. So I think that's probably reflective of those of why those statistics are the way they are. But they are troubling and I would say concerning, and would warrant kind of further investigation, I suppose, is to discover what were the rationale behind the guards levying that number of fines in certain areas.
Set this aside, the geographic point is very important and requires further investigation. But if you set it aside and you look at the data across decades of criminological studies and public order offences and how that's tracked, that tends to occur from people who are younger than 26 across the board, COVID or no COVID anyway. So it's not, you know, I'd be less surprised by that side of things, but I think the geographic one is very important to look into.
I think one of the things as well, Katie, you know, like we had some very high profile cases of breaches of public health restrictions, like I'm thinking of the Dublin GAA team, you know, that the Irish Independent reported on extensively a few weeks ago, and the guards decided not to levy any fines in that instance. Now, look, they've made that decision, the DPP agreed with that decision, but from a public perception point of view, I mean, that looked on the face of it to be a very clear breach of the public health restrictions.
Well, what happened? Is Golfgate over?
Well, Golfgate is but you see, actually, in that instance, in fairness, the guards have recommended, I believe, recommended charges against a number of individuals in relation to the organisation of that event. And that's a matter, obviously, that will come before the courts at a certain point, I suspect. But, you know, obviously, but I mean, that's four. I think it's between two and four individuals, whereas there was quite a lot more at that event.
There was, yeah, but I suppose to be clear, the regulations at that time only put an onus on the organisers, individuals. Yeah,
and of course, there was a lot of consequences for those that did attend in terms of
yes,
and
I have it here. Four people, including two politicians, are facing charges over that event. So we will say no more about that because that is pending. Yeah, Pather.
Yeah, but just like young people have had a horrific time over the last 15 months. They have sacrificed massively, even though they are the cohorts who are least affected by this particular illness. You know, they have, you know, their college has happened online. Their experiences, formative experiences in relation to relationship building, socializing, have all been put on hold. 60% unemployment in that. You know, you can, and if you look at these individuals, they're typically also, if they can afford to live outside of the home, they're living in, you know, apartment blocks with no gardens, and some of the geographic areas with the lower number of fines and etc. are places where people have space to socialise, have a drink and be outdoors, etc. So, you know, I definitely think that young people have had a really tough time with this and deserve a break.
I'll just give you a sense. We're getting a big reaction in on our text line. Here's Kieran. While risking stating the blindingly obvious, COVID should be treated and planned for as a health issue, not an issue of law and order. Another one, the capital city of this country should not become a no-go area because of the presence of an aggressive alcohol-filled mob. Another texter says, get real, the problem is alcohol drinking in a public place is illegal. And yet another listener says there are large groups intent on causing trouble who don't care about policing by consent and regard this as meaningless. They want confrontation with the police, says David in Dublin. And will you stop this nonsense, our Gardaí, you're coming under attack by young people intent on trouble. Liam Herrick.
Well, I think the last year has been a very challenging year for policing, and the guards have had extraordinary powers, unprecedented, to be able to stop and stop people and ask them where they live, where they're going and why they're moving around. And by and large, the guards have done very well in being moderate and proportionate in the use of their force. But one of the big dangers all the way through, Katie, was that they would be uneven and discriminatory policing, that they'd use these extraordinary powers in an uneven way against some sections of the population. And for the first 6 months, there was an agreement to guard against that, that there would be no prosecution of anybody for violating COVID guidelines or COVID regulations without consultation with the DPP. But when the government moved to have fixed penalty fines, on-the-spot fines, we very quickly saw this problem emerge of some sections of the population being imposed with the fines over others. And age is a big factor. And I don't accept that it's because young people were breaking the law more. It's because, as Jennifer said, there's a history of young people being targeted more by policing, not just in Ireland, everywhere. So there are people who are middle-aged socialising in ways that might be in breach of COVID regulations, but they're not likely to be given fines. And when we see people being prosecuted for organising protests or small events, and then other high-profile groups who are organising events in violation of regulations not being prosecuted, it feeds into an undermining of confidence in policing. And I think that's a serious matter that we should be concerned about.
Right. OK. Liam, Herrick, many, many thanks for joining us with that this evening. We'll leave that one there. I think we'll take a break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And just another text here on harking back to our earlier discussion about buildings and whether or not they would be COVID friendly or COVID inspected before people are asked to go into work. I have one here. I'm trying not to be alarmist, trying not to panic, but I'm going to start work in a restaurant in a few weeks. I have no idea when I will be vaccinated. I'm 31, so probably September. The restaurant is in a 300-year-old building. Opening a window will only do so much. The clientele will probably be mainly 50 plus with a vaccine and feeling like they don't have to be careful anymore. So that's I'm sure there are many people in that position who are nervous about going back to work in those circumstances. And here's another one. Dublin City Council parks are open until 9 or 10 p.m. at the moment. OPW need to be asked, why are they closing Ivy Gardens and St. Stephen's Green at 7 p.m.? They seem to be getting away with this with no criticism. Is Stephen's Green closing as early as 7 o'clock on a summer's evening?
I've seen different reports, to be honest. I'm not sure what it is on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, we will maybe check that out and get back to it. But I want to move on because opposition parties have accused the government of failing to provide for a just transition in the forthcoming Climate Action Bill. An Oireachtas committee heard today that the legislation does not have sufficient protections for sectors which will suffer job losses as a result. So this is obviously the bill that sets out the plan for Ireland to transition to a carbon neutral economy by 2050. But what kind of a transition will that be? Can I ask you just in relation to Eamon Ryan's declaration that the government isn't going to accept any opposition amendments to this bill now at this stage? It's in committee. So how is that a good way to proceed in terms of drafting or crafting legislation? To just declare, sorry, we're only taking government amendments now.
I actually didn't hear him declare it like that.
He says that the bill is sufficiently robust and any future amendments would come from the government only.
Oh, all right. Well, he's adopted 70 of the 78 recommendations at pre-legislative stage, which actually was a really good debate. And there's a lot of different interest groups fed into that. And I know that they accepted that. There's also a second piece of legislation to come specifically in relation to just transition and putting a just transition commissioner on a statutory basis. And I think that's a really important point and was a big part of the debate today. The bill does need to be enacted as well. And it has gone through extensive pre-legislative scrutiny, as I've said. So I hadn't heard him say that, if that is as you say. But I think that probably reflects the extensive work at pre-legislative stage, really. It's an incredibly ambitious bill and we need it to be in law as quickly as possible. It is one of the most ambitious in the world in terms of its commitment to net zero by 2050, in terms of its commitment to limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. It was prepared in the last Oireachtas by why the committee chaired by Hildegard Nocton, it has been significantly strengthened and again in this government and then again in pre-legislative scrutiny. It does need to be enacted now.
The Dáil has been bypassed left, right and centre by this government. You know, the emergency restrictions we have is the Dáil being bypassed. But this is an example of the democratically elected people representing hundreds of thousands of people being told that their views, their suggestions, their proposals are not worth anything and they won't be accepted. And to be honest, you know, the best legislation is the legislation that's most tested by the opposition and most impacted by the opposition. You know, I do want this to be an ambitious bill, but there's no doubt in my mind that the bill does not take into consideration what's happening in rural Ireland at the moment. So one reference in the bill to just transition, no definition at the start with regards to what that actually means. So therefore, it's up to whichever government is in place to decide what that means for the people of rural Ireland. And, you know, I've said this before, we are developing into a city state. We are developing into a lopsided state at the moment. 35% of farmers, for example, make a living from the farm alone. And that figure is reducing on an annual basis. You know, we've had the last number of years where farmers, for example, are selling their beef to factories at a price below the cost of production. Now, any government that's presiding over that is not showing that they mean business with regards, you know, the just treatment of rural Ireland anyways. So how can we map that the government are going to change their behaviour in the future if that's what their track record now?
Padder, I mean, as I said, the government has appointed a just transition commissioner who's now on his third report in respect of the Midlands. We're putting that on a statutory basis. The recommendations are being implemented.
How many jobs have been created through this?
There
so
is
far?
Funding to try to help people retrain into other employment community initiatives.
How many jobs have been created so far?
To say that there's no just transition programme in relation to it, first of all, it's in the bill more times than you say. Second of all, there's a separate bill actually dealing with that specifically. Third of all, there's a commissioner who's already in situ doing that work.
Could you just rebalance it a little bit? Okay, well, we've already had factories, we've had Bordemona plants close. Yet there hasn't been one job created through the just transition as of yet. So what you're saying is you're front-loading the pain to communities across rural Ireland, and yet we're told to wait patiently and hopefully that the government will be good in their word with regards to the creation of jobs. Many people in counties like Offaly, Westmeath, Laois, for example, they won't have seen the government good on the word with regards to economic development. What they know is actually commuting to Dublin, and for more people, that's what this will mean.
And that's why the National Planning Framework, as you've said it twice now tonight about the state being lopsided, and you're right about that. The state has been lopsided, which is why the National Planning Framework, which is put on a statutory basis in 2018, tries to limit the growth of Dublin to only 25% and push development to the other cities from a climate perspective and a planning perspective and a rebalancing the state perspective. That is what the Oireachtas has committed to. That is what the government has committed to.
48% of infrastructural spend happens in the greater Dublin area. Where the infrastructure is built, the people will go.
Okay, Annie.
I don't think in relation to climate change you can ever be robust enough or you can ever be ambitious enough. So I think it shows a level perhaps of arrogance to say, well, actually, no, we've got it right now and that's that. And I actually think the minister in hand, if this was a different Dáil, would be very much on our side, the opposition party side, and would be supporting our cause and would be supporting our amendments. So the Labour Party, my colleague Deputy Duncan Smith put in amendments. There was a lot of opposition cross-working together, putting in very similar amendments because not to try and trip up or trying to make things difficult for the government, because there are people who very deeply, passionately care about this. And the fact that, you know, jumping around being like just transition's mentioned once, it's mentioned twice. The fact that we're even having to have that conversation, I think, shows a real lack of ambition and a lack of commitment actually to the concept. You know, we can't have people in the Midlands or in rural areas crying out and saying that they are not getting the just transition that they've been promised. And then for the government to turn around and say, well, look, we're not even going to listen to anything that anyone's saying. We're not going to take any amendments. We're not going to engage in it. And we're just going to plough this on through because we have to get done.
But Annie, that's not it. Did you participate at pre-legislative scrutiny stage? Because it was very, very extensive. I recall speaking to a number of different groups, and I wasn't even on the committee, with the opportunity to participate in that. that. But it was very detailed. I have never seen a pre-legislative scrutiny process where 70 of the amendments suggested by the committee out of 78 were taken on board directly into the bill.
It's the most important stage, Padraig, because the reason that it's the most important is because
if you don't do that, then the bill that's produced is a sort of a fait accompli by really going through pre-legislative scrutiny and really taking on board what
you're
said.
There's nobody arguing with that point. All we're talking about is this stage here.
So what I'm saying is at the most important stage in terms of framing the bill, the government took on 70 of the 78 suggestions made by the Oireachtas Committee, and which was fed into in a huge way. Now, there's separate legislation.
But is it very unusual?
And I honestly don't know the answers to this question, but is it not unusual for a guillotine almost brought down in terms of, okay, this is the amount of amendments we're taking in,
and I don't care what you say, I'm not taking another amendment from any member of the opposition.
That to me sounds very unusual. It depends on the speed with which the bill is being prioritised, the speed with which it needs to be enacted.
But imagine if we had a dog where the idea is the force, the evidence was actually enough to get things passed, rather than actually everything being a fait accompli in just a theatre.
Okay, sorry, I just want to, Hugh, you've covered a lot of committees, I'm sure.
Is this an unusual statement from the minister?
I think he's probably just being honest
about what governments with majorities have done for years. I covered the 2011 to 2016 Dáil very extensively. That was the biggest majority in the history of the state, I think.
Wasn't there a special approach being taken to this legislation, though, to try and bring everybody along? And it was going to be a collaborative effort.
Well, I mean, I think that's what the what was, you know, what the government will say was achieved during pre-legislative scrutiny, which is what Jennifer's outlined there. But I mean, I think from the this isn't unusual behaviour from a government with a majority. I'm not saying it's the right behaviour or the correct behaviour, but it's not unusual behaviour with a government that has a majority. And, you know, look, say what you want about Eamon Ryan and the Green Party and the way he's running the Green Party, but this is like this is the raison d'etre of the Green Party. This is why they're in government, and this is what they need to deliver, and they need to deliver it as quickly as possible. And I think he probably takes, I don't know this for sure, but he's probably taking the attitude that having done the pre-legislative scrutiny, accepted the amendments that he accepted, that he just wants to get the thing through now and get on with you know, getting that carbon neutral economy by 2050, because it's an enormous challenge.
Pre-legislative scrutiny has changed legislative development in a very important way. It was introduced by the Fine Gael Labour government in the 2011 government, and it gives the opposition a real opportunity to shape and craft the bill in a way that never happened in the Oireachtas.
But ministers
prior
frequently
to
look to bypass pre-legislative scrutiny.
Not with great success. There was an attempt to do that in the Justice Committee, but it's up to the committee to agree to it or not agree to it, and it depends on the bill. So, for example, in the Justice Committee, we've agreed to it in certain technical procedural bills. We've not agreed to it on other bills, for example, the judicial appointments legislation. So it depends on the bill. It depends on the committee.
OK, just before we go, I just want to mention the Leaving Cert tomorrow, because I don't know about you, but I'm certainly looking forward to all the tweets from all the TDs wishing all the Leaving Cert students good luck tomorrow and assuring them that this exam that they have put their heart and soul into passing isn't really the be all and end all after all. But all joking aside, there is an understandable level of anxiety, I think, down in Limerick among school principals in advance of this exam starting tomorrow because of the COVID levels in the region. Because of the setup this year, because there is no backup papers, if somebody wakes up in Limerick tomorrow and has hay fever symptoms, they've been told they cannot go in and sit the exam that they have worked towards and soldiered through very difficult times. Is that fair?
Well, I think without going too far into a diatribe of why the Leaving Cert in and of itself is an unfair system, you know, the system is based on either you perform on the day or you're toast. Arguably in this
there's a
backup in this one with the accredited, you know, with the accredited grades. Arguably they've got a better backup than any other year has ever had. But that is not an unusual way to do the Leaving Cert. We've always had a system, a very unfair system, which bases everything on a one day exam. And I think the students, when they only found out last week through a tweet from a government member who then got deleted, saying that the results were going to come out on the 3rd of September, and that sent students into an absolute spin because that was going to make the entire year everything much later. The tweet was deleted and it was confirmed a few hours later by the minister that indeed the Leaving Cert was once again going to be, the results were going to come out, I think, the 3rd of September, the CAO on the 6th of September. I had, you know, staff in universities and IOTs and TUs were furiously now trying to recalibrate their start of terms, and that was extraordinarily stressful for students to
get
that. It was,
but do we have to acknowledge, though, that what's happening this year is really extraordinary, that they've managed to put together two individual systems. Mm.
I think it's incredible
grades,
that they've turned it around, but they shouldn't have found out the week before on a tweet. That wasn't a fair way to do it.
Jennifer.
Yeah, I accept that. I mean, the important thing is how much time have you got once you get your CAO offer? You know, it wouldn't make any difference to me if I got my results on Thursday and an offer on Friday. What I'm interested in is how long have I got to consider that offer? And Simon Harris confirmed this weekend that's going to be the same length of time. So that's important. But this year is different. And it's just shown us how ridiculous the Leaving Cert was for so many years, the pressure of a single system. I remember repeating my Leaving Cert and going into hospital the weekend before I had meningitis and having to do exactly that and sort of do it on the hoof, you know. And there's been people in that situation all the way through, people with epilepsy having a seizure just before their exam and having to do the exam anyway. The accredited grade model is a good backup, and okay, it's come out of COVID, but you know, it's one that we should seriously consider, that sort of hybrid model for the future to take the pressure off people on a given day.
Yeah, I think the system is improved. There's no doubt this year than it was on the last year. And I know it is a cliche, but tomorrow's and the work that happens or what happens in the next few weeks will not determine people's the rest of their lives.
You got ahead of the tweets tomorrow. Okay. Okay, just to clarify very quickly, Stephen's Green apparently usually closes around 9 p.m. at this time of year, but there are some reports of it closing an hour earlier on a day when problems arose. So that's that clarified. And that's all we have time for tonight. The programme was produced by Caroline Dalton. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. Mark Dwyer was on sound. I want to thank my panel for coming in to me this evening and for joining us on the line. And I want to hand you over now to Colin Murray on Late Date.